This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. I'm your host, DJ SusD, short for Sustainable Design, also available on radioforall.net, and of course, archived on kpw.org. All right, so today there's an event on December 17th in Portland and across the world to decriminalize sex work. So I have Elle Stanger of the Oregon Sex Workers Committee on decriminalization and sexual surrogacy. So that's about 40 minutes of material I got here. So I got a couple of things on the New Zealand method. New Zealand has decriminalized sex work quite successfully. So I just got a couple of snippets of that. A little disclaimer here. The one issue that keeps coming up for decriminalization is healthcare and disease. Please, at all times, use your own brain at all times. Research this stuff yourself. We're just trying to open up a dialogue here. You're on this ride with me. I'm not an expert. I'm an expert in sustainability, but not an expert in everything. So during the AIDS epidemic, it started in 84. I didn't really hear about it until 86. But my own personal observation was that once the health department got the information out to people, it was the community that stopped the AIDS epidemic. And it was important to have a relationship with the health department. The community had a relationship with the health department that they weren't afraid to go to the health department. And this is another reason why we need to decriminalize this stuff, is so that sex workers are not afraid to go to the health department. And just my own opinion, just as another little disclaimer, to me, AIDS is what I call a deforestation disease, and that is where AIDS came from. It has absolutely nothing to do with the gay community. Just want to put that out there. As we cut down the forest, you're going to see much more of these strange diseases. All right, thanks for listening. So coming up, the New Zealand method of decriminalizing sex work with Elle Stanger of the Oregon Sex Workers Committee, and you can get more information on the December 17th demo. It's OregonSWC.org, and your browser may block you, so you go to OregonSWC.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. We're on our pledge drive right now, so we'd appreciate it if you'd go to KPW.org and become a regular subscriber. So here's a little more information on the Oregon legislation to decriminalize sex work. At the end of the 2023 legislative session, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek used her veto power to stop state funding for two studies totaling $600,000 intended to research the impact of Oregon's laws prohibiting prostitution. In doing so, she stepped into a centuries-old debate about whether or not the world's oldest profession can ever be entered into voluntarily, or if it is a legitimate form of work and should instead be decriminalized. And this is from the Oregon Capital Chronicle. This is by Juliana Shumway, May 6, 2022. Oregonians won't get a chance to vote on whether to decriminalize sex work this year after backers of a ballot initiative ended their campaign Thursday. The proposed initiative would have made it legal to buy and sell sex in Oregon would have treated sex work like other occupations, subject to an employment law and state health and safety standards. Petitioners were running out of time to gather more than 112,000 signatures from Oregon voters by July 8th to make the ballot, in part because advocates for survivors of human trafficking sued over the language that would have appeared on ballots. Signature gathering couldn't start until after the court case was resolved, which could take weeks. Aaron Boonshoft, a Portland resident who sponsored the ballot initiative, said in a statement to the Capital Chronicle that he'll continue pushing to decriminalize sex work that could take the form of another ballot measure in 2024 or legislative action. Before Boonshoft filed his initiative last year, State Representative Bob Noss, Democrat of Portland, introduced a bill to decriminalize sex work, but it didn't make it out of a legislative committee. "We're committed to sex worker-led decriminalization efforts," Boonshoft said. "All Oregonians should have access to health, safety, and justice. And I believe sex worker rights are at the forefront of what's needed to create a more just, kind, and compassionate world." Boonshoft is the son of an Ohio commodities trader and describes himself as not employed in recent campaign finance filings. He gave a combined $275,000 to progressive district attorney candidates in Washington and Marion counties in April. The initiative campaign previously described him as a client of legal consensual sex work. The initiative petition Boonshoft withdrew Thursday was actually the second attempt after initially filing last November, after Secretary of State Shamia Fagan rejected proposed initiatives on campaign finance reform for not including the full text of the state laws that would affect. Boonshoft withdrew the first petition in January. He filed again with 1,000 signatures from Oregon voters, the first step in getting an initiative on the ballot. Supporters also faced a legal challenge from a group of Oregonians concerned about human trafficking who said in a complaint before the Oregon Supreme Court that draft ballot language approved by Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum would mislead Oregon voters by not emphasizing how the measure would protect pimps and people buying sex. They agreed that sex workers should not be subject to criminal charges. Petitioners are involving themselves in this process out of a concern that IP51 will further marginalize sex workers by providing special legal rights for sex purchasers, pimps, and brothels, their court filing said. The sex work initiative is the latest high-profile proposed measure that won't make it before voters this year. Fagan and the Oregon Supreme Court blocked attempts to limit campaign contributions for technical reasons, and earlier this week, supporters of an independent restricted commission said they were giving up and would try again in 2024. According to Elle Stanger's profile on stripperwriter.com, she is a queer, mid-30s, non-monogamous, parent sex worker, ASECT-certified sex educator and media producer. She has worked as a porn shop manager and product buyer, pole dancing stripper, consultant for anti-trafficking organizations, professional cuddler, porn maker, writer, podcast host, and certified sex educator. Her Strange Bedfellows podcast was named Best Sex and Politics Podcast You've Never Heard Of by Portland Mercury and earned 100,000 subscribers in 2 years.
Except that we can do better than the current messy law, and that this bill is a workable improvement.
MPs today received letters from Tim Barnett urging them to vote for it and urging those supportive of it to change other MPs' minds. The margin will be narrow whichever way it goes. The last vote saw it pass with a two-vote majority, but some MPs have decided to switch their votes at the last minute.
Are you confident it'll get passed, or are you a bit concerned now?
I haven't felt like this since I stood in a courtroom with a woman who was facing soliciting charges, and that was fairly touch and go.
Just over 2 hours, MPs will begin the final controversial vote on whether to give legal protection to prostitutes. And both sides of the decriminalisation debate predict a narrow victory. Political reporter Garth Bray explains.
Tim Barnett gets his last chance to sway the doubters.
Will 61 of us vote to remove the last significant vestige of Victorian moral law from the New Zealand statute book? Yes, Mr. Speaker, I believe we will.
The ayes are 60, the noes are 59, abstention 1, the bill will be read a third time. Unlock the door.
Unlock the door!
It doesn't get any closer, but all it takes is one vote more than your opponents to change the rules.
At the start of today, I knew that we had between sort of 58 and 63.
Some of the credit went to Georgina Byer's impassioned speech.
But please, I beg of you, I beg of you.
The former sex worker's harrowing tale of a knife point encounter silenced a packed public gallery.
It would have been nice to have known that instead of having to deal out the justice myself afterwards to that person, I may have been able to approach the authorities, the police in this case, and say, I was raped. And yes, I'm a prostitute, and no, it was not right that I should have been raped because I said no.
Good evening, welcome to Late Edition. The world's oldest profession is now legal in New Zealand, but the move to decriminalise prostitution squeezed in by only one vote, and it was passed after a handful of MPs changed their minds.
I remembered when I first came into Parliament, I stated I had a permanent interest for marginalised groups, women, Maori, Pacific, all those who struggled to live a life of dignity.
This is a conscience issue, and I respect every MP who exercised their conscience last night.
Catherine, the tangible difference as far as you're concerned that's going to make to the industry?
I think it's going to make a huge difference for the way people feel to be marked as a criminal, to be documented, to be registered by the police and monitored as a criminal actually stands in the way of many crimes being addressed. And this is going to make a huge difference.
How hard did you work to twist arms on this?
We continued to promote the bill, talking about the principles behind the bill. We linked these to practices and consistencies that we've dealt with over time. We've had a lot of support from the community, from different agencies.
Can you swing a politician?
I don't believe so. I think they, you know, certainly they have their own opinions. They're influenced by a number of people and a number of issues. And I think politics comes into play as well.
I feel quite extraordinary at the moment. And
decriminalised sex work is of great help to sex workers. It means that they're no longer looking over their shoulders and thinking, are the police coming today? They're no longer having to hide condoms. They're no longer having to worry about search warrants being served on them for where condoms can be seized and used as evidence against them.
For me personally now that the laws have been decriminalised, I have a lot more pride in being a worker, because when I was illegal, you had no rights. But now I sort of got a lot more rights as a worker, which is very empowering in a way that I know that I have the rights to work or not work. And should I work, I know that I have the rights as every other person who's employed.
I've worked for about 15 years as an adult entertainer and sex worker of various types. So I currently work as a dominatrix. I do phone sex and porn making. I have done escorting, also known as prostitution, work before, but it is not my main type of work. And most notably, I've worked as a stripper in Portland, Oregon, and around for 14 and a half years, full-time, except for COVID shutdown, and 6 months off for pregnancy and 6 weeks off for a boob job. So I am very entrenched in the adult industries in specifically Portland area, but I also work as a podcast host and producer for Portland's voted best Portland podcast a couple years in a row, They Talk Sex podcast. So I work and I talk with therapists, other educators, other people in adult industry, social workers, teachers, people in clergy, all kinds of people are impacted and do work around human sexuality and harm reduction. I'm sure I'm leaving some stuff out, but I'm also a board of director for the Oregon Sex Workers Committee and the second longest member, I think. It's been around about 3 years. And that's a nonprofit comprised of current and former sex workers, primarily in Oregon, but also located around the world. And we have support from our volunteer allies who may be friends, family, or clients, or parents, or offspring of people in the industry. So I do a lot of time talking to people, and this includes folks that have either been incarcerated or arrested or detained or abused by the court systems or police. People, some of which have experienced sex trafficking either by their parents or their caregivers or their small offbeat like religious community or cult that they were living in. Some of the people I interact with are still trying to escape dangerous or exploitative situations. Most of my peers and people that I network with are choice workers, and that is people that have chosen to do sex work either before or currently. But yeah, there is sometimes people that have experienced coercion or are currently still dealing with it. So I try to be a support where I can, but always take a survivor-centered approach. So that's some of me. Thanks for having me.
All right, so you got into a little bit of what the Oregon Sex Workers Committee does. Can you elaborate on that? But also, hasn't all of this increased since the pandemic? All of this, everyone was thrown out of work, both online talent and prostitutes were all thrown out of work. Is that right? And so isn't that why the Oregon Sex Workers Committee was started?
Well, no, actually. The pandemic was interesting because for people like myself who do both in-person and online work, my work just shifted to online. So I started making more videos and things. And the last time I did any full-service sex work, which is the preferable term to prostitution, because prostitute is often used as a slur. So I invite your listeners and you yourself to refer to escorts as full-service sex workers. So my last escorting gig that I did was early March of 2020, right before shutdowns and before I knew a lot about COVID. The reason Oregon Sex Workers Committee started was because we need decriminalization of prostitution-related laws and statutes in Oregon. We need it really bad. We need it around the country. We need it around the world. Some places have already decriminalized, like New Zealand or New South Wales. Belgium did it 2 years ago. The reason we need decriminalization is because currently in Oregon, about 90% of police anti-trafficking funding is consistently used to create fake ad listings for adults seeking other adults, posing as sex workers. And then when these would-be clients respond to them because they want touch or companionship or excitement or arousal, they are arrested and often labeled in the news media as people who are participating in sex trafficking because it is funded from the anti-trafficking budget. But these people were actually just charged with, consistently, if you look and you read what their charges are, if someone is being charged with pandering or solicitation of prostitution and there's no mention of minors, it means that they're an adult who thought they were engaging transactionally with another consensual adult. A lot of taxpayers would not be okay knowing that the cops use so much money intended to prevent trafficking when actually in the participation of targeting people who are just interacting, although illegally, still by the consent of other adults, which is not sex trafficking.
All right, and so decriminalization, though, would actually curb trafficking. Is that true?
That's absolutely true, because anytime you try to criminalize most things that are commodified, you create a huge opportunity for underground markets. The easiest parallel is when, about 100 years ago, American society and government, in opposition to alcoholism and unemployment and domestic violence, they thought that making alcohol production and consumption and distribution of alcohol illegal. They thought, we'll just make booze illegal. You can't buy it, sell it, or make it, and then all these other problems will go away. Turns out that's not how that works. People who were in perfectly legal, regulated businesses operating the way that they always should have been, they're now out of work. They're shuttered, their business, you know, their family screwed. Are they going to stop making alcohol? Maybe. Or they might make it, you know, bootleg or underground. This also gave rise to the mafia and the mob that could be connected to the police so that certain venues are allowed to produce or sell alcohol, you know, speakeasies, as long as they pay off the cops or the mobs that's running them. This is why so often police are actually engaging in the trafficking or the exploitation of people because they're the ones who have access to them unfettered under the current model.
All right, and there, and I just want to—you've touched on it a little bit, but I just want to elaborate that they are the anti-trafficking. A lot of it is has a religious right behind it. Is that correct? They are lobbying Congress to make sex work a crime, and there is no one lobbying. The Congress is not listening to anyone from the other side. So you guys created the other side.
Yeah, exactly. And sex work activism is actually centuries old, and in America, decades old, and was closely linked to the civil rights movement. Most of the black people who were trans or gay or queer in the 60s and 70s, much like now, who are doing activism work, many of them have friends or family who have had to hustle sex work to survive and are the most likely to be arrested or targeted or visible or marginalized. One of the biggest examples and bad players in this that is quite prolific with misinformation And they've now reached over to the mainstream and to leftists themselves because of brilliant marketing. So NCOSE, National Center on Sexual Exploitation, is what they call themselves. You can look them up, ncose.org. They were founded in 1962, called Morality in Media, as a right-wing organization that was explicitly against published erotica or nude depictions. So they were very anti-porn then. They're very anti-porn now. In the early 2000s, they changed their name to sound like a legitimate research or credible organization, National Center on Sexual Exploitation. If you go to their very website, if you scroll to the bottom, the last time I checked, they equate stripping, which is something I do three nights a week for the last 14 and a half years, with slavery. They equate porn with child sexual abuse. Can people be bad actors in these realms? Certainly. But me dancing for dollars and talking for tips is not inherently dangerous. People who try to steal from me, you know, hurt me physically, expose me in a way, or block me from employment, the stigma, the discrimination, that's what hurts people. So sex work is not inherently dangerous or violent, but how you treat people is what matters. And these organizations do not want to make sex safer or sex work safer. They want to make it more difficult for people to engage safely. And that's what they do by refusing housing or benefits to a survivor of trafficking unless, say, that person no longer does sex work. A lot of organizations will not give services to people unless they either claim they were being trafficked, which really messes up statistics on trafficking, because if you're forcing consensual workers who are endangered and marginalized to claim that they're being trafficked when they're not, it makes it look like trafficking is actually more prolific. But what the issue really is a lack of resources. And a lot of these organizations, if they find out that you're still seeing clients or stripping or doing webcam, they will cease any support services to you. And this could mean, you know, childcare assistance or legal fees. So it forces people to act as victims, because in many cases, that is the only way some people want to treat us and to think of us.
All because of a stigma. So can you talk about the dormant, though, because of this stigma, because of it's a crime, sex work is a crime, then people are enabled, like doormen and hotel workers and hotel front desks, all of that. Can you talk a little bit about those are kind of, they're not unwitting, they just end up in the position the same way a speakeasy it was because of it was illegal for alcohol.
Right. So we talk about third-party facilitators. If that sounds like a really boring term, but when we say third-party facilitators, or when it comes up in conversations around decriminalization versus legalization versus full criminalization, third-party facilitators might be my husband or girlfriend or bestie who drives me to an appointment or acts as security. They could be charged, and people are in places where third-party facilitation is a crime. These people are charged with assisting in prostitution, which is considered a crime. This forces people to work alone, which endangers them more. So in some places around the world, it is legal for one sex worker to work, but it may be considered a crime if there's two or more of them. So this is one way that clients who are malicious and sadistic will knowingly use this as an opportunity to prey on people. In places where full decriminalization exists, like New Zealand, it's not a crime to be working sex. So if your client does something that is still a crime, such as rape, robbery, force, fraud, coercion, that client, that person can be charged with those crimes. Here in America, most sex workers are not able to come out because what they were doing to make money is illegal or highly stigmatized. Oregon says that it doesn't arrest people working in prostitution. However, I hear all the time from mostly women who are detained or interrupted, and they're very confused because they say, I work for myself. why are you charging me with any kind of commercial sex crime? I'm working for myself. And some people are forced to go through a program which costs $1,400. It is casually referred to as John School, because usually the men who are arrested, the would-be clients, the would-be buyers, they, in order to avoid jail time, you pay $1,400 to go through the diversion program, aka John School, which is funded partly by the police and partly by LifeWorks. This is where you sit through presentation where you're given a ton of misinformation. I'm being told this by people who had to go through it themselves. The misinformation given is that by purchasing or paying for sexual favors, you are contributing to trafficking, which is like saying by buying food, you're contributing to someone else's food poisoning somewhere else. Like, that's just not the case. And it's a lot of sex negativity, shaming, like, oh, you're going to get an STI or you're going to pass them on, which, again, is less likely to happen in places where sex work is fully decriminalized, because screening and condom use and barriers are encouraged and way more easy to access.
All right, we'll get into that, but let's make a distinction, though, between legalization and decriminalization. I noticed you had an example on there that really blew my mind, was that we didn't legalize gay sex. You don't have to have a card to have gay sex. Why should you have to have a card just because you are using, just because you're exchanging money for sex? Mm-hmm. Why should you? So that's the difference between decriminalization and legalization, right? Nevada has legalization there, and the women are still exploited.
Right, absolutely. So legalization is great for brothel owners. And when I speak to people who have worked in brothels, and I say have because by speaking up, they are in a position that they can't go back because, you know, word travels, so they can't go on the record. But brothel owners love legalization in Nevada because they can say to their applicants, their people working there, you're safe if you work here. You're going to get raped or arrested if you work out there in the big bad world. But you do pay out 40 to 50% of what you make. And a lot of places you're audio monitored the entire time so that you can't negotiate for more or be tipped without the house knowing about it because they want the percentage. Okay. So if that's the only environment where you can work in Nevada in order to not be arrestable, I don't want it. Because who's going to necessarily even hire me if I don't fit their booking standards? You know, I'm heavily tattooed. I have very short hair right now. The older I get, the gayer I look. So, you know, there's also people who are visibly disabled or bigger bodied that are just not going to be hired by a lot of these venues. So they're still arrestable. So decriminalization is the opposite of that, where as long as you are a consensual adult with another consensual adult, you know, there's no minors involved, there's no force, fear, fraud, coercion, extortion involved, then you're good to go. Legalization means that people usually have to pass certain or tick certain boxes to be able to be hireable or for the government to give them approval. So that might look like needing a fixed address or giving a social security card. If you are nomadic, if you're a migrant, if you're poor, if you don't have a fixed address, if you're a runaway, you automatically wouldn't be able to be a registered sex worker if that's a very basic requirement. It's kind of like you can't get a P.O. box if you don't have a piece of mail that shows your address. And this makes it very hard for people without addresses to get mail, which is something else we don't, you know, really think about. You see what I'm saying here? And then also, in order to not be arrestable as a client, you have to be able to go to these brothels. And these brothels are always in isolated desert areas in counties that have chosen to legalize brothel keeping. Reno and Vegas are the most populous cities, and they do more prostitution-related arrests than anywhere else in America, as far as I am aware. And it's in the very same state where sex work is legalized. So,
right, because it's so difficult for sex workers to go to a brothel, mm-hmm. that it's easier for them to just do it from their house,
yeah,
even in Nevada.
Call or alcohol, yeah. Go to the client's house, go to the hotel room,
which is
their car,
which is illegal in Nevada. All right, and then so what happens with, give me some examples of, there's many examples of people, because they have this arrest or they have this on their record, now they can't get schools. You've touched on it a little bit, but now they can't go to LCC or state college. They can't apply for jobs. What else happens when you have this on your record? And then it perpetuates a downward spiral.
Yeah, if you are applying to any job and they ask you to list your convictions, solicitation or prostitution-related convictions, even if it doesn't bar you from the job, it opens you up to all kinds of harassment from anyone, you know, your hiring manager, anyone with loose lips who talks about it. And sex work is incredibly stigmatized. There's all the time news stories about a school teacher or someone who worked as a nurse where it was discovered that she or he has an OnlyFans on the side. And even though their current clients or patients or students would never have rightful access to that paywalled material anyway, just the fact that it exists somewhere is then considered to be grounds for someone's termination, even if they're perfectly capable and good at their job.
And they might not. Then they might not even be doing it anymore. This might be something they did in the past, partly to pay for their schooling, and now they've got it on their record, and it shows up when they get a job.
Nikki Gilliland is an excellent example. An Oregon case. There's not a lot of media about this because Southwestern Oregon Community College SWOC has done a great deal to bury it, and the staff that harassed and kicked her out of nursing school out of Coos Bay several years ago. This was all due to a instructor there who is very well-liked and very entrenched in their social work and their nursing programs. It's a small city over there. So my friend Nikki Gilliland did porn at the ages of 18, 19, 20. She was a foster kid who aged out of the system, didn't have any connections, so decided to pursue that interest and make some money. After 3 years in the porn industry with no regrets, she pivoted to healthcare. She worked as an EMT. She worked in ambulances. She survived some domestic violence situations with her ex-husband. She was a parent of two kids. So when she finally decided she wanted to enroll in SWOC, she was there for a short amount of time until she was afraid of someone else ratting her out because of her custody issues with her ex-husband at the time. So she divulged it to her instructor that she had done legal adult work as an adult a decade prior. The teacher started changing her grades and then accused her of plagiarism before flunking her out of the program. When my friend asked, Nikki Gilliland asked, and this is all on record, she went to court about this. This was, I'll try to find the case for you, but I think it's Gilliland v. SWOC. When Nikki asked the instructor, "Why are you doing this to me?" the instructor, who is in nursing and social work, said, "Nursing is a classy profession, and unclassy women," pointing at Nikki, "don't deserve to be nurses."
Wow.
So, in fact, legal work.
Right, and it seems to me they would have better knowledge or an additional knowledge for a nurse.
Yes.
All right.
Exactly. Turns out working with people's bodies in stressful situations can be really helpful and teach you a lot of skills.
Uh-huh.
The end of Nikki's story, I sat for at least one day, only one day I was able to make that trial, but it was down in Eugene at the courthouse, and she won that case against discrimination because the school failed to protect her from discrimination under the Title IX gender clause. So she won a settlement, but the school is still challenging it, so she actually hasn't won anything at all, and she lost custody of her kids during that time and was branded as the Scarlet Letter whore in the town. She was spit on all because she dared to enroll in a nursing program and then fight the instructor who turned on her. So it's just, and this stuff happens all the time. When Nikki's story was shared, so many people reached out to me and said, "This happened to me. I was kicked out of nursing school. I was kicked out of teaching because I did adult work in the past."
Mm-hmm. So what does decriminalization look like in New Zealand?
So I hear it's pretty nice. One of my good friends is over there still now. She has dual citizenship in the States and New Zealand. She has worked under decriminalization New Zealand on and off for some years and still currently does. She has worked under criminalization in America. She has worked under legalization in some European places. And she speaks different languages. So I'm always really interested to learn from her. She's just one person I know, but definitely the most well-traveled. She also has her master's in public health from Johns Hopkins University and is a public health researcher. So I get to hear all kinds of interesting correlations all the time. In places where sex work, full service sex work, is decriminalized, the workers have better safety. It's actually more statistically dangerous to be a cab driver in New Zealand than it is to be a sex worker, which is just kind of, I mean, unfortunate for the cab drivers, but unheard of over here. If a client tries to remove the condom or does remove the condom without consent of the worker, which is known as stealthing, that client can actually be charged with a crime. And they're very, very strict and particular about condom use over there in decriminalized New Zealand as a approach to reduce STIs, transmission and HIV. And places where sex work is decriminalized have an overall lower transmission rates and outbreaks of STIs and including HIV.
All right. Well, I got to ask why that is. I mean, theoretically, you know, like when the AIDS epidemic happened in the 80s, it was really the gay community. It wasn't Fauci that stopped what was going on. It was the gay community. So wouldn't it be the community itself should manage diseases? If a disease were to break out, the sex worker community itself would be able to take care of that. And we would have a more robust healthcare system in our country also.
Yeah, so I'll tell you some examples of why and how that is. So for a while in New York, as one tactic to, I don't know what the hell they were thinking, but for a while it was a crime to be carrying condoms while streetwalking in New York. And what this looked like was cops would stop obvious street workers, which quite often were people of color and quite often they were trans, because these are the people who are more likely to have to work outdoors because they're less likely to work in, you know, modern day speakeasies or secret brothels, or to be able to post on escort websites, which are expensive, or use social media if they don't have the, you know, the technology. So sex workers, if they were stopped by cops and had condoms on their person, that means in their purse, in their pocket, in their shoe, whatever, then they could be charged with a crime because the condom was considered evidence. So as a result, sex workers stopped carrying condoms sometimes because they were hoping it would mean they were less likely to get arrested. You hope the client has one, but that's not usually the case. As a result, STI rates went up because people were able to use boundaries like they wanted to, or barriers like they wanted to. Another example is general healthcare inaccessibility. Like, Texas got rid of so many clinics that provided abortions. Clinics that provide abortions tend to do overall and preventative care more so. So if people can't even screen or get condoms or birth control or dental dams in the first place, they're going to have a harder time protecting themselves. So we need a greater density of clinics anyway for all people. And again, you know, back to New Zealand, like, you have to use condoms there. That was one of the trade-offs of decriminalizing sex work. They said, what can we put in place for people to have more of a safeguard? And there's some argument that it's overly restrictive and, you know, people should be able to negotiate, which I do agree with to some degree.
Well, whatever. The point is that decriminalization is not keeping disease down at all. And registering sex workers, I mean, they do it in Mexico, and I don't know that...
I would be scared to... You know, who holds that information? Does the person who holds that information then have the list of where to go find you and harass you for sexual favors? Or a lot of us, yeah, we communicate with each other and we know how to keep ourselves safe. And so for me, that means before I film with somebody new, I have the talk. When was the last time you got screened? What outbreaks have you ever had? You know, what have you ever knowingly contracted? What are we going to use? What are we going to not do? For many porn production companies, there's a database which is all industry managed. It's not government managed. It's not public health organization managed. It's not private organization. You know, it's the company. And there's, so the database, there's performers that in order to be actively filming and working with each other, they have to do a blood draw and a full panel of testing every 11 to 14 days. And they do it, and that's normal, and that's life for them, and that's part of the job.
Well, and it's for their own, it's for their own advantage.
Yeah. We want to protect our instruments, our bodies are our tools and instruments. And so when, you know, outsiders or non-sex workers talk crap about, you know, whores being dirty, it's like many of us actually are way more invested in our sexual health than you.
Right. And so maybe it's some education maybe might need to be done, but certainly not criminalization.
Education needs to be done.
So let's transition there into, you are also a sexual surrogate, is that right?
I am not, but I work with an interview surrogate, so I can talk about this.
All right, and what, sexual surrogates have an organization in Oregon, is that right?
So there's a couple different organizations in Canada and America. So IPSA is the International Professional Surrogates Association. So yes, international, but the folks I know, they're probably IPSA licensed or certified. So in order to become a surrogate partner, you have to do an immense amount of training, and you're going to be working with a therapist or counselor that the client is seeing. So not a lot of states necessarily participate. It's still kind of a gray area. I don't want to say underground, but it's very much at the forefront of its field. It's only a few decades old. So how accessible this is to you may depend. I know a guy out of Canada who does it, and then another nice man out of Virginia. And so basically this might look like, say that you go to your therapist and you say, I have erectile issues, or I have a fear of being touched at all, or if you're a woman, you know, maybe, well, if you're anyone, but I'm thinking to personal experience, a woman who says, you know, I want to have my first sexual experiences as an adult in a transactional way because that will feel safer than maybe some of the abuse I experienced as a child. So that's when the therapist agrees that it would be beneficial for you to work with a professional, that the first couple of sessions might just really be talking and practicing the client being able to state their no or to state their preferences, just so that they can feel empowered. Because a lot of people who are seeking out surrogate partners, they're dealing with anxiety. And a lot of people who are seeking out sex workers may also be dealing with anxiety. Not all of them, but some of them certainly are. So there's definitely cases where I've met people who could benefit from surrogate partner therapy. And then there's plenty of other cases where surrogate partner therapy wouldn't be necessary at all. This person is not experiencing distress or crisis or anxiety around their sexual function. Maybe their sexual function is just fine. I'm an accoutrement, you know, I'm an accessory to that, or I'm a marital aid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it really depends on what people need.
Well, let me just give you my experience with it. I had a psychiatrist that, this guy was my pediatrician. He had known me literally my whole life. He had become a psychiatrist, and this was in 2000, I think 2001, and he found me a sexual surrogate, and, and she was in Venice, and she was an ex-Playboy model, and what she was going to do, she hooked me up with, well, first of all, she did exercises where I would touch her face, and because she's trying to get you to be more sensitive to the other person, so there was a lot of work like that, and then, but I only did this for a little while. She had a personal trainer that she was going to hook me up with to get me my body in shape, and then she had some friends, this was in L.A., where prostitution or where sex work is illegal. So she had a group of friends that she would introduce me to once I got my act together, you know, once I had gone through the program. So, but let me tell you what I've noticed is, and I'm not saying she did this wrong, but what I notice is that the client themselves have a lot of say in what the therapy is. Is that true? Because the reason I stopped it is I was riding my bike over from the San Fernando Valley to Venice to try to get myself in shape, which is this huge ride over the Santa Monica Mountains, yeah, to try to get myself. She got mad at me for doing that, and I'm like, no, this is my way of losing weight, and I'll work with your personal trainer too. But she wanted me to stay strictly with, and there was some confusing. I got a bicycle stolen and everything, so I'm not criticizing her at all. But I'm just saying,
yeah,
there is an element that you, the client, has a say in what the therapy is, because to me there's a trust issue too. I've talked to sexual therapists about you need to be able to trust the person that you're with.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's 100%. Granted, it was 20 years ago. I'm curious if she would do anything differently today. I am a little suspect of the fact that she was going to maybe introduce you to people after you finished sessions with her. Because to my understanding now, it's understood that, you know, sessions will come to an end. They do have a timetable. There's a goal in mind, which is get the client to a point where they feel more functional or to tackle this thing. And then you say your goodbyes. So it could be she really was just bummed that she wanted you to go to her guy. Because, yes, it should be self-led. And if you were into riding your bike, then I would fully support that.
Yeah, so that was my own. And like you say, that was 20 years ago. Well, so and then I just looked it up though recently, and it's this therapy that you're talking about with a sexual surrogate and a sex therapist is like $8,000 to $10,000 to do that.
Probably, yeah. So probably, I don't know how insurance works with any of this, to be honest.
Right. No, I'm sure the insurance doesn't pay for it, but I mean, can't we have something in between there though?
Right.
I mean, do we really need to go that far? But I mean, I think. Sexual surrogacy should be a health care issue. Am I right? Is that right?
Yeah, 100% right. And what's interesting is in other countries like the Netherlands, it is. There was a clickbaity article that I dug into a little bit more. It says that citizens on their disability can get $100 a year or so, whatever a year that, you know, whatever it equates to over there, that they can use for a sex worker. And it's actually, they get a certain amount of funding, and if they happen to use it for a sex worker, that's okay because it is legal over there. So to go a step further, if it was decriminalized, then that would be, you know, more accessible for the worker. In America, here, I definitely know therapists who say they wish they could legally refer to a sex worker if it was decriminalized. And in the types of sex work that is either decriminalized or currently legal, like webcam or subscribing to someone's OnlyFans or going to a strip club, some of them do. Some therapists, you know, they do say, they're like, I think you should go to this dancer and maybe talk to her and she'll give you a shoulder rub and let you cry. But yeah, it would be cool if they were like, you know, you just need like a couple naked massages.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Instead of, you know, so can there be somewhere, and if it was decriminalized, we could have just something, you know, in between that, and I think men need to be, well, so who is it that uses this stuff? Well, first of all, this is all, Masters and Johnson was who came up with this type of therapy, is that right, in the 70s, and who is it for? What was your experience? You talked a little bit about some of your experiences.
So Kinsey, the researchers, you know, the Kinsey Institute and Masters and Johnson, but specifically Masters and Johnson, when they were doing a lot of their sex research, they were notable for hiring sex workers, because who better than, you know, to hire people who are experienced and competent and comfortable with sexual responses of other people, right? Again, so who pays for services, I think, was something you...
Yeah, what type, who needs this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, some sex workers are also clients. I have clients who are also sex workers because they too want just to feel some relief or some pleasure or some, you know, release, or to bring their partner and have a good time. A lot of my clients are men. Not all of them are. I would say for me personally, maybe about 70% of my clients are men. I have some queer clients. I have some women who identify as bi-curious or bisexual or straight, but, you know, maybe they've never touched breasts before besides their own. So it's really, you know, The other thing I wanted to say before is one of the other human rights abuses that happens when police do these decoy stings to arrest would-be clients. So sometimes people with intellectual disabilities are arrested in very violent, expensive, messy raids for their family and their caregivers. I talked to one lady who in Washington, basically a SWAT team smashed down their fence and arrested her intellectually disabled brother who was responding to an ad because he wanted to spend money to have a pretty girl touch him and hang out. And he didn't know that was a crime. He's an adult. He didn't know that was a crime. And now they're in this legal battle. He's still being charged with solicitation of prostitution. So it's very much a human rights issue. How do we, you know, allow people to experience pleasure consensually as adults in all kinds of different formats or ways?
You know, this is me, a man, saying this, but I would think women would want this, really, because you really would want a man to be trained. Is that insulting to anybody? Or?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, of course. Yeah, I talked to a friend the other day. She's now a woman. She transitioned a few years ago, and she doesn't do sex work at this time of her life. But when she was a man, she did sex work, and actually in the Los Angeles area, and sometimes to celebrities. And it was very interesting to her, to hear her tell me, as if I needed convincing, that women actually do pay for this, especially wealthy women. And I said, oh, I'm sure.
Right, because these are men that know how to please a woman. So, yeah.
Well, Chip and Dale.
Well, yeah, because I mean, if you read Lady Chatterley's Lover, the most important part of that is that men were really just using women like a vessel or whatever. It was horrible.
Oh, yeah.
The way men were treating women sexually, it was just horrible, and it was accepted in that day.
I mean, and it's still very accepted now. And I'll say one more thing to some listeners who might not believe this or might find it true to their own experience. Would you believe that some people are very happy to offload sexual labor onto another person if they don't want to deal with it in their spouse?
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people who are like, no, I don't want it for my husband. No, I don't want it for my wife. We're not going to divorce because we have house and kids and boat and insurance and business. But yeah, if he could just go deal with that somewhere else and be so much relaxed later,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's no emotional component for some people at all.
And it's discreet, and you're not having an affair, a love affair with someone either.
Certainly. Oh, yeah. Certainly. Yep.
The other organizations, there's an International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. But what about the Sex Workers Outreach Project with the Behind Bars and this SPFPP?
Yeah. So International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers is December 17th this year in 2023. It will be the 20th anniversary. This day was started to acknowledge and remember all of the victims of the Green River Killer, who hunted for the women that he killed very much along the I-5 corridor, specifically between Seattle and Portland, and specifically also in downtown near 2nd and Burnside, where I dance three nights a week. So it's very close to home in the fact that this is a regional begun day of remembrance, and also we have lost friends to violence and overdose, as always, this year. So we're going to be doing, Oregon Sex Workers is doing a vigil and gathering event in Portland. If you're interested and you want to attend or donate, we are heavily screening for attendees, but it should be a hoot. So email OregonSexWorkers@ProtonMail.com. Swap Behind Bars is a different organization that's fantastic and does different services than us. They are based out of Florida, and they work with incarcerated women specifically, many of which have been targeted in police stings because Florida arrests sex workers way more aggressively and purposefully than Oregon does, as a result of it being a more sex-negative space in general, but that's a different conversation, different but related. So Swap Behind Bars is great. Sex Work Outreach Project, that is a national organization, and they have different chapters in different states. And then lastly, so SPFPP.org, I know there's a lot of letters I'm throwing at you. So that is not a sex worker organization, but that is a herpes stigma and research nonprofit. that provides therapy to people who are impacted by herpes shame. It's run by a good friend of mine, Courtney Brame, and it just really relates very strongly to a lot of sexual stigma that people feel. Herpes is very common, whether or not you're a sex worker, but I always like to shout them out because they do great work.
All right, Elle Stanger of Oregon Sex Workers Committee, trying to decriminalize sex work. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you for listening. Thank you for opening your mind to other people's ways of living.
All right, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Curtis.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his coke from Colombia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid. His lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member, or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.